Welcome to Keeping It Real with Frankie D, the very first Italian-American podcast and the home of your Italian-American moment. I'm your very proud host, Frankie D, and we can be heard at ItalianAmericanLife.com, on iTunes, Stitcher, your podcast app. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, connect with us on LinkedIn, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Today's episode is a special one. In addition to my very special guests, we have reached a milestone here at Keeping It Real with Frankie D. This is our 100th episode.
Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I'd like to introduce my special guest. His name is Don Fiore. He is a writer, historian, musician with the Caliendo Banda Napolitana and Cavaliere Ordine della Stella della Solidarietà Italiana. He recently has had an article published in the Ambassador magazine for the National Italian American Foundation in the winter 2022 issue, titled The Italian Aviator Francesco De Pinedo. De Pinedo's flight routes made air history. De Pinedo, a very important figure in Italian history and a story that needs to live on. Don, welcome to the show and thank you for being my 100th.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
Yes. No, thank you. It's we've been doing this about 9.5 years and we got to 100 and that's special. And I am truly glad that we are doing this interview because these are the kind of stories that, well, thank God for you, will live on because... this is a gentleman that lived, that was born in 1890, and the story was kind of being forgotten. So please enlighten us about Francesco De Pinedo.
Well, De Pinedo was born in the Santa Lucia district of the city of Naples, which is right on the sea. And so he grew up being close to the sea. He came from an upper middle class family. His father was a lawyer. And he always had a great love for the sea. So when he became of age, he enlisted in the Royal Italian Naval Academy and went for a career in the Navy right at the time, right shortly before the eruption of the Italo-Turkish War in 1911. And he was just of age. He was an ensign and he served destroyer duty in that war. That was 1911, 1912. And as we know, shortly thereafter, World War I erupted and he joined the Navy, he stayed with the Navy, obviously. And around towards the end of the war, the Royal Italian Navy had developed its own aeronautical arm, aviation arm, and De Pinedo applied for that and went through his flight training very quickly and got his pilot's brevet and finished the war in the air, flying reconnaissance. Now, I should preface this when I mentioned the 1911 war in Libya when they fought the Turks. That was the first time in history that heavier-than-air airplanes, actual airplanes, were used for wartime purposes by the Italians. They were the first to do that. That has been completely forgotten. When we think, especially in popular American imagination, when we think of the pioneers of aviation, I mean, what comes to your mind? You're going to think of Americans, British, French, maybe German, you know, but you're not going to think of Italians. Well, in fact, that the Italians were at the forefront of that. The only two uses of an airplane in military uses that they didn't effect in the Libyan War were troop transport, because the planes obviously were too small for that, and air-to-air combat, because the Turks didn't have aircraft. But had the planes been bigger or had the Turks had airplanes, they certainly would have done those too, and it would have been a full scope. So by the time De Pinedo was learning to fly, Italy was already pretty well established as an upcoming air power. Then after the war, the situation that happened in Italy, and this is very important because all this is important, this story and how De Pinedo's flights came about. You know, prior to the war, Italy was mostly an agricultural country. It relied, its economy was largely agricultural based, but the demands of war shoved it into the industrial age. And by the time the war started, I think the Italian Air Force, or it wasn't an Air Force, it's the Air Corps, had 79 planes. By the end of the war, they were producing 700 planes a week. That's how big the aeronautical industries in Italy grew during the war. Some of the most notable planes were the Caproni bombers. They were the first of any of the belligerents in the war to stage massive bombing raids, strategic bombing raids, involving several dozen of these massive Caproni bombers over the Alps, over the Adriatic to blast the enemy. So all these industries grew. Italy had probably, by the end of the war, had 30 different aircraft manufacturers. And then when the war came, since they had no peacetime industrial economy before the war, when the armistice was signed, the government naturally canceled all the contracts because they were so deeply in debt. And that meant this complete massive layoff of all these industrial workers. The aeronautical industries had something like 75,000 workers just dedicated in the aviation industries. So this added a lot of, well, go ahead, you asked.
I was going to ask a quick question. I'm curious, how did this compare to other countries as far as producing airplanes, the amount of people working on airplanes?
Yeah, I mean, they had reached where they're pretty much the equivalent of the other countries. And that's what the problem was. You know, Britain, let's use Britain and the United States, but we could use Germany too, for that matter, although Germany was on the losing side. They had peacetime industrial economies. Okay, for an example, say there was a firm that was making toasters, okay, a peacetime product. The war comes out, they change to making machine guns, right? Mm-hmm. For the duration of the war. When the war is over, they just go back to making toasters. Follow me? Whereas in Italy, there was so little industry going on. So all of a sudden, these new companies start making machine guns, making aircraft, making all this stuff. The war is over. They've got nothing to go back to because all these were formed on the demands of war. On top of that, there was demobilization, and you're returning millions of young men into the peacetime economy, and there are no jobs, all right? All these guys coming back, and it wasn't like the United States where we followed the war, where it was all these years of prosperity in the 1920s or Great Britain. Italy was total chaos. You had massive unemployment, right, and real clumsy, and the government being hopelessly in debt from the war, because that's where Italy wasn't in the same scale the United States and Britain. They stretched themselves to get up there, but they didn't have the money to back it, so they relied on loans. Well, after the war, all these loans were due, and so it was just terrible. And as you know, that's what ultimately brought about the rise of the fascist party, because it was composed mostly of these veterans, young men, who found themselves back home after the war with no jobs. And they resented that because what had they been fighting for all this time?
So they were motivated by anger.
Well, of course, yeah. And the situation of the economy and the fact that Italy didn't get everything that it was promised as far as territorial gains of the war. They felt that a lot of their sacrifices had been in vain. But the Italian government then, the air ministry, they had all these planes on their hands. So many of these aircraft, what are we going to do with them? A lot of them were just outright destroyed. But then somebody got the idea of, let's see if we can sell them to nations that have no aeronautical industries. So what they started to do in the 1920s, they started to send goodwill flights. They're usually manned by veterans. And they would try to accomplish some major feat, like the first flight between two European capitals, or the first flight to here or there. And hopefully where they would land, there would always be a big celebration and everything, and they hoped to get a few contracts to sell some of their aircraft. And they even did this to South America. They shipped a bunch of planes to South America and toured around there. One pilot, Antonio Locatelli, made the first flight over the Andes Mountains from Chile to Argentina and back, and things like that. And the biggest one of all, and this is where DiPinello is going to come in. In 1920, there was aviator Arturo Ferreira, Lieutenant Arturo Ferreira. He just knocked everybody's socks off by flying from Rome to Tokyo. And that was just ridiculous. I mean, it's such a huge flight. And the celebration was was massive and everything like that. It was a very unplanned flight. It was pretty much him hopping in his aircraft, and he tore a page out of Atlas for navigation, and that's what he did. So years later, this continued, and it was relatively successful, this program. DiPinedo had been transferred now to the Regia Aeronautica, that means Royal Italian Air Force, and that was founded in 1923, and that was the second independent air arm formed in the world. The first was the British Royal Air Force, where it wasn't part of the army. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It was its own independent thing. Italy was the second with the Regia Aeronautica, and DiPinedo was transferred from the Navy to the Regia Aeronautica. And in 1925, he was a little bit before that, he began studying the possibility of repeating Farrarin's flight, but including Australia into it, and making this massive flight from Rome to Japan via Australia. And he chose to do this in a seaplane. Farrarin had used an SVA, Ansaldo SVA, which was a beautiful biplane that the Italians built during the war. I mean, it was like comparing the other airplanes to a Stradivarius. I mean, it was the most beautiful, capable, agile biplane. That's what Farrarin had used. But DiPinedo was a big believer in hydroaviation, that's using seaplanes or planes that can land on water, flying boats, because his theory was most of the great cities of the world are built alongside a great body of water. And he even envisioned someday that commuters would use seaplanes to go to their jobs and fly from suburban ponds to rivers and city or lakes and dock their planes in parking lots. Anyway, he studied Farrarin's route and everything he did, and he said, I think we could do better if we repeated in a seaplane. So he planned it out much more meticulously than Farrarin, who did it by the seat of his pants. He arranged for refueling stations, all at strategic plots along the way, and he actually made the trip. It took him a long time, circumnavigated Australia, and he logged probably close to 40,000 miles when he did that, and he did his round trip flight. So that made him, really shot him in Italy, but also all over around the world as, you know, a real path opener, because all these flight paths that he opened, it was kind of a rough and tumble. He had a flight mechanic with him. It was him and Ernesto Campanelli. Different things they would have to do. They would land like they ran out of oil. They couldn't find any aviation oil in India, and so they found castor oil. They bartered some things of castor oil, filled the plane up with that, or, you know, always makeshift stuff, but they made it intact. So when he returned to Rome, he was considered, you know, the greatest pilot in Italy and everything like that, last celebration. Italo Balbo had in the interim been appointed Undersecretary of Aviation, and he referred to DiPinedo as Il Signore delle Distanze. That means the Lord of Distances, or the Gentleman of Great Distances, because of what he was able to do. So they started talking immediately, well, can we top this? Italy was really starting to gain prestige, and stuff like this was helping them. And also a big part of it was, and I'll repeat it, they were looking for markets for their manufacturers, okay? The plane that Balbo used was a biplane, a seaplane, and it was an S-16 made by the Savoia Marchetti aircraft manufacturer, and they would emerge up until World War II as probably Italy's premier aircraft builder. They're just ingenious, the things they came up with. So there had been, at that same time, you might be aware of Umberto Nobile. Have you ever heard of Colonel Umberto Nobile?
No, right.
He was the director of the lighter-than-air arm of the Italian Air Force, the, you know, dirigibles, that type of thing. And in 1925, his dirigible that he built, the N1, with an Italian crew, and also with the Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen on board, completed the first complete crossing of the Arctic, the North Pole. from Spitsbergen all the way over to Teller, Alaska. And that was like 2 days after Admiral Byrd reached the pole. But Byrd, and even that's in doubt, just reached the pole and turned back. But the Nobile kept on going until he reached Alaska. Now, a little bit later, he tried for a second flight, but this time just strictly with Italians on board to drop the Italian flag in the North Pole. And the plane crashed, or I mean, plane, the dirigible crashed. And this was a real harrowing, big news. Most of the people were rescued, but it was a big tragedy, all right? So Mussolini was a little bit worried. Di Pineda was talking about doing a round-the-world flight. And Balbo and Mussolini thought that might be a little bit too ambitious, and we don't want another disaster on our hands. So why don't we limit that to just a Atlantic crossing, a double crossing of the Atlantic, which was still very difficult in those days to get over the Atlantic. So he began formulating out his next itinerary, and that would take him, and this time he was using an S-55, which is incidentally is the same plane, earlier model of it that Balbo would use when he made his crossing in 33. It was an incredible aircraft. It would take them to, from Rome, they go to Africa, and then from West Africa, they would make their jump across the Atlantic, the South Atlantic, and their target was Natal, Brazil. Once they reached Brazil, they would go down to cover Uruguay, Argentina, Paraguay, and then they would enter the rainforest and to complete the first aerial crossing of the Brazilian rainforest, which they managed to do. After they left, crossed over, they followed the path of the Amazon, which was very difficult because the tree covering was so thick that if they had to land, they couldn't even see where the river was anymore, but they managed to do it. And from there, they went to the Caribbean, made a few stop-off points in the Caribbean, and finally, on May 27th, they landed in New Orleans. And that was the first foreign airplane to reach the United States on its own power.
And what year was this?
May 27, 1927.
So it in these years, can we assume that Italy was the total dominance innovators of aircraft manufacturing and pilots?
If it wasn't, it was close. Okay. And I think where we can see this exemplified the most, its only real serious rival in Europe was Great Britain. And where we can see this, there was something called the Schneider Trophy races. And this is really a good example of, if you want to see where Italy stood. That was founded before the war in 1914. And was this gentleman, he was a millionaire named Jacques Schneider. He was actually French. He created this contest for, everybody thought seaplanes was going to be the future. This is just what the thought was at the time, of a speed race between, every nation would enter like the Olympics, their latest model seaplane. And it would be a speed race where they'd race against the clock. And at the beginning of the war, you know, Germany participated, France, and then the war burst out and it just had to cease because of the war. But then after the war, it was revived and Italy joined it. And at first, I think Italy's first year was 1919. And the United States is in it, France is in it, the Dutch are entered it, everybody. And every 2 years, the race were done every 2 years, and your country was expected to bring back a newer, faster aircraft, higher technology every 2 years. And it got to the point that by 1926, only Britain and Italy were left. They were the only two nations participating because the other countries either couldn't keep up technologically or the expense was just too much to invest. And how this thing ended, I got to tell you, because by the time we got to 1930s, it's vicious between the British and the builder of the British aircraft was Supermarine. They would later build the Spitfires during World War II. The builder for the Italians was Macchi, M-A-C-C-H-I, Macchi Corporation. Today it's still in business, known as Air Macchi. They built this monster aircraft called the MC-72. If you saw a picture of it, I wish I could show you a picture of it, you'd think it was built last year. I mean, it is so advanced. The wings are almost paper thin. The wings acted as the radiator and everything. Anyway, this aircraft clocked in 1934 at 440 miles per hour. And that was setting all-time record. It was not broke until the 1980s. That's how long that record stood for a piston.
Wow, that's a long time.
For a piston engine seaplane. That's incredible, okay, how advanced Italian technology was. Now, the problem is people are going to ask, well, how come they did so bad in World War II? And the reason they did so bad in World War II was they, in the laboratory, on the bench, on the test field like that, they could pull stuff off like this. What they couldn't do is turn it into mass production, okay, because they just didn't have the economic power to build a lot of these things. So when World War II finally did come, you found everybody was converting to metal-clad aircraft, and the Italians were still building them out of plywood. And it wasn't because their technology didn't work. It was because they couldn't afford it. And that was a sad point of about Italy. But to give answer to your question, nothing points to where Italy stood better than those Schneider Trophy races, because the other countries just couldn't compete. And, you know, Mussolini was really big and stuff like that. So he poured tons and tons of money into aeronautics and everything, because that was viewed as the way of the future. And the image of Italy he was trying to project was up to the minute and modern and all that. So that's why they focused on that. So when they did land in New Orleans, their original itinerary, this we're getting back to DiPinedo, was to fly to San Diego, and then up the California coast, then fly across the continent, land in Chicago, then New York, then up to Newfoundland, and from there fly back to Italy on the North Atlantic, which is much more difficult. Well, I shouldn't say much more difficult, I'll say much more challenging than South Atlantic, because South Atlantic is difficult too. The North, though, you're facing a really, really worse weather as far as, you know, temperature and cold and everything like that. So unfortunately, DiPinedo and his group, he had a crew of three. He was a commander. And then the co-pilot was Captain Carlo Del Prete, who was a great aviator in his own right. And the flight engineer was Sergeant Vitale Zacchetti. So it was the three of them. And what was cool about these guys is, you know, their airplane, surprisingly, the Savoia Marchetti S-55 in 1927, was still an open cockpit. So these guys are flying through all kinds of weather. And yet whenever they get off board the plane, they'd always be wearing their Reggio Aeronautica uniforms that look like they were freshly pressed and everything. And people would be mystified by that, because here you see an aviator and he looks real rough and tumble. And these guys' eyes were very pristine. Another cool thing about their aircraft, they kept a gramophone on it so they could listen to music during their flights.
Really? Wow.
You know, wind up gramophone and records, and they would, so they could hear music, and they kept a few bottles of wine, and I mean, it was typical Italians. They had to land for refueling at this reservoir in called Lake Roosevelt in Arizona, and locals gathered around to watch this process. He had made arrangements with Shell, was the provider of the fuel, all along the route, along the itinerary, to stop for refueling. So the station was waiting there for him. But a bunch of locals showed up, and they wanted to help. And among them was a 18-year-old kid who was smoking a cigarette. And he tossed a cigarette in the lake where there had been spilled fuel. Nigh the fuel, the plane caught on fire and was burnt to a crisp. The name of the plane, by the way, was the Santa Lucia, to imitate Christopher Columbus, obviously, because he was flying to a new world. On his first flight, he named all of his planes after saints, by the way. The first flight to the Orient was the Gennariello, which was named after San Gennaro, who was a patron of his native town. So right away, you know, it was suspected, obviously, that might have been sabotage, that this plane was destroyed. But
did they ever prove it?
Huh?
Did they ever prove that it was done on purpose? Or
no. The kid came forward. He was real tearful. He said, "I tossed a cigarette." And so DiPinedo had a press conference and he said, you know, the destruction of our plane was unfortunate incident caused by, you know, the carelessness of a young boy. And I'm sure my government will see it that way. And Mussolini issued a statement saying that we recognize it was an accident and we don't hold the United States responsible for anything relating to that. We're not going to let this stop the flight. And so what they did was Balbo ordered a manufacturer of an exact replica of the Santa Maria. I mean, all the way down to the gramophone he put inside of it. And they shipped it by boat to New York. So DiPinedo, the U.S. Navy, first the United States offered to pay it, to replace the plane, pay for the rebuilding, and the Italians refused. They said, we'll take care of it. They shipped the plane to New York. And in the meantime, the Italians were flown to by the U.S. Navy or U.S. Army, flew them to San Diego and the different cities they were supposed to stop at. And then they got on a train and they rode the train back to New York City, where the plane was, when it arrived, it was waiting for them.
Did he make it to Chicago?
Yes, he did. He did. So what he did, when they had the plane back, they stopped, they met President Coolidge, greeted them in Washington. They stopped off in Washington and got in the plane and they returned to New Orleans, which was the point that they started on the United States. But they had to shorten their schedule because of the delay, it was over a month. But also DiPinedo had his eye on something else that was going on in aviation. There was something called the Ortigue Prize. It was another Frenchman offered it for the first nonstop flight between the United States and Europe, okay, $25,000. Now, DiPinedo wasn't interested in participating because, number one, he couldn't have done a nonstop flight because he didn't have the capability with that aircraft to fly that distance nonstop without a refueling point. But he knew if somebody did that while his flight was going on, it would blow him off of the front page. So he wanted to hurry up and line it up and get his second Atlantic crossing done before anybody tempted this Ortigue Prize. So he landed back in New Orleans, and that was the year 1927. If you look back at almanacs and anything about that, 1927 was a disastrous year as far as the weather. It was just constant rainfall. Mississippi was flooding. Everything was a lot of disasters going on as far as excessive storms and rains. So DiPinedo was originally scheduled as he started to fly up the Mississippi. He was headed for Chicago, originally scheduled to stop off at St. Louis, but he had to cross that off because the rain was delaying him. So all these people in St. Louis had gathered to see him land, and they could only catch a glimpse of him as he flew over the city. But he landed in Lake Michigan, Chicago, and about 10,000 people were on hand to greet him when he landed here. And he stayed here for 2 days. He visited, there was banquets for him, the local Italian-American community held a big banquet for him, and the city held a banquet for him, your typical thing like that. And then he got off, he left in the morning on that Tuesday, and he flew to Montreal, stopped off in Montreal, and his next stop was Newfoundland. And from Newfoundland, they were going to fly across the North Atlantic, okay, with a stop off probably in the Azores if they needed refueling. While they were trying to get, there was really rough weather going on when they were scheduled to take off. And, you know, when you want to take off a seaplane or one of these flying boats, you want the water to be a little choppy. You don't want it to be smooth, but you don't want it to be ridiculously because you can overturn your boat, I mean, that fast. So the weather was so bad in Newfoundland that they kept on delaying the takeoff. Well, let's give it another day. Let's give it another day. Meanwhile, in New York, this young guy, Lindbergh, hops in his plane, which was not a seaplane, and he makes the flight and lands in Paris. And the world just goes nuts. I mean, that's when, and DiPinedo was, you know, still, but he was all of a sudden on page 20 now. He wasn't on page one. Up until this point, it was page one. Well, page one is Lindbergh. I mean, by all means, see? So when DiPinedo finally does get across the Atlantic, it could not be more anticlimactic. You know what I mean? Because the whole world was focusing on Charles Lindbergh. But he still was greeted as a hero in Italy. And I mean, his like his picture around the recruitment posters for the Italian Air Force always had his picture on him saying, "Don't you want to be like Di Pinedo?" and all this stuff. And he received the promotion. He was now General Di Pinedo, not Colonel. And Italo Balbo now is in full force. Now, Italo Balbo's policy is entirely different. He doesn't like the idea of what he used to call the prima donna, the one aviator celebrant hero. That was against the whole idea of fascism, which is meant to be a group effort. That's the idea of fasce, combined effort, right? So he strives to discourage, okay, you did your thing. You know, Nobile did his thing, ended in disaster. You did your thing, got a lot of accolades, which he did, by the way. The United States presented him with the Flying Cross, which they almost never give to a foreign aviator. And the British gave him the Royal Flying Cross for this double land crossing, which they almost never do to a foreign aviator. So I think they just wanted to remind everybody that Lindbergh wasn't the only guy who flew a plane in 27, you know? So what Balbo conceived of, Balbo by now was becoming very recognized around the world as he was the youngest air minister of any country. And he also was one of the few that actually knew how to fly a plane. So he participated in a lot of international aviation conferences, a big one in Washington, D.C. And he was so impressed in the United States because he did a tour of the United States, said Balbo. He feels sorry for his wife because he brought his wife to the conference. And he said to her, "We're going to go on a tour of the United States when the conference is over." So she naturally thought they were going to see Mount Rushmore and all these things like that. No, they visited the Ford Motor Plant. They visited the aviation, all this stuff like that, because he wanted to see what the Americans were doing. And I feel sorry for the poor woman, because how bored was she, you know? Anyway, it was there that he conceived someday we're going to fly the United States. It's not going to be one aircraft. It's going to be multiple aircraft. So to build up the idea of a mass flight, Balbo founded a school for long distance aviation with the Royal Italian Air Force Academy. And he planned several mass flights as test flights with Di Pinedo in charge, because Di Pinedo was unquestionably Italy's top aviator. He was a better pilot than Balbo. Nobody disputes that, not even Balbo. So the first flight was a flight to Spain, from Italy to Spain, and that involved 60 aircraft flying from Italy to Spain. And for you to understand this, Frank, that's never been done. 60 aircraft flying in formation, nobody ever did that, right? And that Di Pinedo plan, with his usual meticulousness, you know, everything had to be just so, you know, all the fuel stations up, spare parts set up, all this stuff like that.
Well, was this a joint effort with Di Pinedo and Balbo?
Yeah, Balbo was the command, not he was the originator of flight. Di Pinedo was the commander of the flight, okay, because he trusted him. Balbo went along, but subordinate to Di Pinedo. Even though he wasn't subordinate officially on this mission, Di Pinedo was the top guy in charge. So it was splendidly successful. You know, they landed without a hitch, got all these monster planes flying perfectly in unison. Everything worked perfectly. So they followed that up with a flight to the Soviet Union.
And is this around, like, I'm guessing, like 1930?
29.
Okay.
Yeah. They followed that up with a flight, yeah, very, very good guess, a flight to the Soviet Union, in which they would visit all the Balkan countries, Turkey, and then land in Odessa on the Black Sea. And that's where trouble started, because Di Pinedo, you know, he was a good guy, but he was pretty vain. And so was Balbo. Okay, you get two guys who think a lot of themselves, you know, and deservedly so. They were both very accomplished. But there were arguments about seating arrangements, like when they would be at a banquet, who would get the top seat, and, you know, just stuff like that. Or Di Pinedo would want to make a change in the route because he felt logistically it was better. But Balbo, for PR, thought it, no, we need to keep it up. And so it got pretty ugly, to the point that when when they were in Soviet Union, DiPinedo told Balbo on the side, when this venture is over, you can consider me out. I'm quitting. So
ego's got in the way.
Yeah. I mean, it just was too bad. So the Soviet Union was really interesting because, you know, it was communism, fascism, complete enemies, right? They're complete opposite sides of the spectrum. And yet it was nothing but goodwill between the two. And there was a one point where Balbo, they toasted to the Russian Revolution. Balbo said, let's have a toast to the fascist revolution. And all the Soviets laughed. They said, what revolution? How many people were killed in your revolution? And Balbo said, well, none, you know. So he said, then how can you call that a revolution, you know? But Balbo thought it just meant the Italians were more civilized, you know. So after those flights, DiPinedo resigned. And Mussolini appointed him. He didn't want to completely cut him out because they both took their grievances to Mussolini. And it was, you know, pretty much who you're going to pick here, because we both can't stay in charge. And there's no way Mussolini was not going to pick Balbo, because that was his old friend and partner and one of the founders of the fascist party. DiPinedo was more of a monarchist, you know. So
well, from this, I'm assuming now this was the cause of perhaps that DiPinedo was not part of the Balbo flight.
Absolutely. No, he wasn't even in the Air Force anymore. So he couldn't have been a part of it. He had resigned, and now he is serving in the embassy as the air attaché to the embassy in Buenos Aires. That's how he was more or less exiled out of Italy, so he wouldn't be any trouble. That's just what Mussolini did to Balbo, if you remember, after he completed the Chicago flight. He sent him to Libya as governor of Libya almost immediately after the flight. And so DiPinedo was also, see, there were a lot of rumors. And everybody said, what happened to DiPinedo? You know, how come he vanished? And the rumor was circulated that he and the princess Yolanda, of the King of Italy's daughter, were having an affair. And that was absolutely not permitted. I mean, this is the royalty here, and it's hands off. So that was one rumor. And nobody knows if that's true or not, if that was going on, but who knows? I mean, all this stuff is so typically Italian. But anyway, around Balbo's getting old, or poor DiPinedo, now he's in his 40s, as we start approaching into the 30s, he's getting old. So according to what he said, he wanted to see how old he was. So he went, and he still had some money. So he purchased a Blanca plane, and he announced, he shows up in New York, and he's got an alias. He's calling himself Mr. Smith, all right? And but everybody knows it's DiPinedo. And he announces that he's going to make this nonstop flight from New York to Baghdad, which would send nonstop distance record, would break that. So he modifies this Blanca. He shows up at Floyd Bennett Field in the morning, they're going to take off. There's all newspaper reporters there and everything. And he shows up wearing a bowler hat, like a derby, and a suit. He's wearing a suit and an overcoat. And everybody thought, man, this guy's gone nuts. He's lost his mind. But he explained that the hat is actually better than a flight helmet because it protects his head from bouncing, which he anticipated. And he just felt more comfortable in the suit. So yeah, it was kind of strange. But he named that plane the Santa Lucia. And that was after a saint, but also for the district in Naples where he was born. The plane was he added extra fuel tanks to it, and it almost doubled its weight for the fuel he needed to get across. So he got on board. It was just the sun was just coming up, and he launched down the runway, and one of the wheels left the pavement, and he tried to pull it back, and it left the pavement again. It just was swaying back and forth. And finally, it hit a barrier and spun, burst into flames. And DiPinedo was seen leaving the cockpit And then he was ejected from the cockpit, climbing back in the cockpit and trying to put it out, shut the engine off. And that's when the explosion, boom, you know, and that was it for him. He was killed. So the Italian government paid for a massive funeral, Cathedral in New York. What's it called? St. Patrick's. They had a big state funeral for him and full honors, and shipped his body back to Italy on the that very famous Italian airliner, ocean liner. Matter of fact, it was the one that brought Balboa, the Di Pinedo's replacement plane, the Giulio. There's the name of the plane, ship, the Giulio, and brought him back to Italy, where he had an official state burial. And that was his story. It was ended.
No, it's sad ending.
Forgotten. The first time I came across his name was from that. I mentioned it's in the article. I heard his song, old 78 RPM, by, there was a singer in the 1920s named Gilda Mignonette. She was a Neapolitan singer, but living in New York. And she sang the song, Volo di Pinedo, in Neapolitan dialect, which meant The Flight of the Pinedo. And every verse in it, it's such a beautiful song, real cool song. E tutto mondo sa lo fa parlare. And the whole world is talking about him. And I thought that was odd because I'd never heard of him. You know, if the whole world is talking about this guy, it's funny that they stopped pretty
quick. And that's how you came to know about Francesco Di Pinedo from the song.
Well, I started to dig, and you know, these are pre-internet days. This we're talking the late 1970s, early 80s, right? So it was really, really tough to find anything because in the United States, no aviation book ever mentions him. Okay. You know, you're digging and digging, there's just nothing. So I had to go to Italy for the information. And the Italian Air Force, Aeronautica Militare, their historical office, sent me a bunch of stuff on him, the biography and everything like that. And I think, oh my gosh, this is great.
Where is that office in Italy?
It's in Rome.
It's in Rome. So you went all the way to Italy?
No, it was all correspondence, no news correspondence. But I did eventually get there when I did get to Italy. Then I just started doing microfilm searches for old papers at the time. And contrary from what you would think today, you're reading in the New York Times, you're reading the Chicago Tribune, and he's front page status, this guy. I mean, not only the American flight, but the Oriental flight or the Asian flight, there's every other day, there's a report of what's going on with Di Pinedo, you know? So you think, wow, this guy's really, really thoroughly forgotten. And then when I was the first time going to Italy in 79 was the second time I was going. You know, the Alitalia, you might remember, they used to name their aircrafts, like give them names, you know.
I don't remember that.
And I was flying on the Leonardo da Vinci, but there was another plane on the field, and it had the Francesco Di Pinedo. And I thought, wow, you know, that's really cool. Obviously, in Italy, they haven't forgotten him entirely. And so that's what I did. Now, I took, worked for so much research on this, and I tried to put it into book form because I thought I could not get a publisher interested. I mean, I must have submitted it to I can't tell you how many. I had more luck in getting things published with other topics of Italian aviation. But it just seems like there was not a lot of interest in this story.
Well, that's a shame, but your research, this is incredible. I am going to YouTube that song. I hope I could find it because I really like to hear it. You think it'd be on YouTube?
I'll see if it is. If not, I'm sure we could track it down somewhere. It's by Gilda Mignonette, or Gilda, as Italians say, and it's called O Volo di Pinedo. And it's really, really a rousing song. It incorporates a little bit of Funicoli for Nicola and the Italian Royal Anthem, Marcia Reale. And it's just very, very...
Well, that's great. I'm going to even take a look at the Italian Cultural Center in Chicago because we have 1,000 records. It's possible that it is.
It might be. You know what was on? There was a series by Fonicita. That's an Italian manufacturer of LPs. They did a series called, it was an Italian historical series of historical music from the 1920s, 30s, something like that. They had it on that too. That was included in there.
Well, okay, no, that sounds great. And I have to say, the one thing that I keep thinking about is when you said that he flew with the music and the wine.
Yeah.
That is so Italian. I mean, that's classic.
The wine is funny because, you know, Prohibition was going on in the United States when he landed, and he was at a banquet in New Orleans, and they were asking, what do you carry on the plane? And he said, well, you know, we've got this and that and, you know, mortadella and all the usual things, and three or four bottles of wine. We said, Dad, everybody, look, wine, huh? And he said, no, we drank all the wine up before we landed, you know, so they wouldn't be drinking a little liquor in the United States. But he was very, you know, the Italians, even in aviation, you know, there's one story that I always get a kick out of. Italo Balbo, he tried to really modernize the air ministry. And in the building, he installed a pneumatic tube system. You know, the messenger pneumatic tube system that you can, you know, like you see at the bank.
Oh, okay.
At the driving, you put your thing, you stick it in your pneumatic tube, takes your message to where you want it to go. He installed that system in the aviation department, and also one going to the cafeteria. So people could send in their orders for lunch. And the cafeteria people started to deliver the lunches through this pneumatic tube system to the desk of the, and so this thing would always jam up because the thing would open up and all of the food would get caught in the pneumatic tube. And Bella said, what are we doing here? You know, this is for messaging. It's not for delivering food. But, you know, what can you do with these kind of people? You know, so.
The Italians definitely have a flair about them, and a lot of the stuff, they were ahead of their time. That is for sure.
Well, with the aircraft, very briefly, if you see a picture of the S-55, once again, like the MC-72, you think, my God, are these guys ahead of their time? Because nothing looked like that aircraft as far as aerodynamics and how sleek it was and how beautiful. So the Italians just didn't build performing planes. They built really good-looking planes. And that's what another thing that they won fame for. So
yeah, they did it all. They did with class. And this is so great because this info would die. And it's so good that, you know, Italian Americans can hear this story and understand the way the power that they had, the knowledge they had, the production they had of aviation,
mm-hmm.
and to remain proud.
That's good. And
yes. Yes,
as we should, as we well should. And that's just one story. As you know, there's so many others that we can cover.
Well, so. Don, thank you so much. This has been incredible. And thank you for all your hard work and your dedication to Italian America. We are definitely more knowledgeable because of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Please keep it up, because there aren't many of you out there.
All right. Well, let me give you a reminder. I turned 70 this year, so I'm getting up there. And
that's nothing. That's nothing. You got a good quarter century left in you.
Let's see.
All right. Well, Don, thank you so much for the article. If anybody wants to catch it, it's in the Ambassador National Italian American Foundation magazine. Like I said, the winter of 2022. And don't forget the name Francesco De Pinedo or Don Fiore. Don, thank you so much.
Before you go, can I mention, I'm working on a contract with Arcadia Books on a book on Balbo's flight to Chicago. And hopefully that'll be out in September of 2023. So
that is awesome. I look forward to it.
See what we can do with that. Okay,
beautiful. Frank. All right. Well, Don, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank. And thanks for having me.